We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you build or deepen your meditation practice and improve your brain health, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpis. When you're finished listening, head over to choosemuse.com/meditationstudio to access hundreds of free meditations. Today's guest is Dr. David Spiegel, Professor and Associate Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, Director of the Center on Stress and Health, and Medical Director of the Center for Integrative Medicine, all at Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Spiegel has more than 40 years of clinical and research experience studying stress and health, pain control, sleep, hypnosis, and a lot more. He's published 13 books on these and many other topics. In this interview, we talk about hypnosis. Why are some people more susceptible than others? What's the difference between hypnosis and self-hypnosis? How can we use hypnosis for sleep, stress, anxiety, depression, phobias, pain, trauma? When I asked him for a simple definition of hypnosis, he said, "Hypnosis is simply a state of highly focused attention. It's like looking through the telephoto lens of a camera. What you see with great detail, but you're less aware of the context." I found his insights and the tools he offered to be extremely interesting. In fact, I tried some of them for sleep and pain on his Reverie app. He's an incredibly skilled and interesting guy. Now, on to Dr. David Spiegel. Dr. Spiegel, it is such a pleasure to have you on our show today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Patricia.
I love this topic, as I was saying to you before, because I know very little about it and have great curiosity. In fact, we're talking about hypnosis and hypnotherapy today. And so last night I went onto YouTube. I have trouble sleeping and I was listening to the different sleep hypnosis audios. So I want to ask you, there seems to be such a range of things that people think about when they define hypnosis. I think what you're doing is very different from what they're doing. But let's talk about that. What is hypnosis exactly? And what sparked initially your interest in studying this and in becoming the expert that you are in this field?
Hypnosis is simply a state of highly focused attention. It's like looking through the telephoto lens of a camera. What you see with great detail, but you're less aware of the context. Have you ever had the experience, Patricia, of getting so caught up in a good movie that you forget you're watching the movie and enter the imagined world? Does that happen?
Would that also be called a flow state that people get into? Or
it could be, yes. Csikszentmihalyi defined flow as autotelic, that you're in it just because it feels good. And hypnosis is often like that. So it's similar to flow. That's right. You just get absorbed in it. It's not effortful. You just want to do it. And you're not judging and evaluating it. You're just having the experience.
Yeah.
So you've had those experiences.
Yes, a little bit, but I am also not somebody that gets into that deep state often. I know some people do. So I find that interesting as well.
Well, it's just highly focused attention, dissociation, putting outside of conscious awareness things that are ordinarily in consciousness to help you focus, and cognitive flexibility is what people used to worry about as suggestibility. Oh, you'll do anything anyone tells you to. That's not true, but you can try out being different. You turn off parts of the brain that normally judge and evaluate how you're doing and what people think of you. And that's a great opportunity for change because you can just see what it feels like before you decide that you've got to do it. It's a very useful state of mental preparation for change.
What sparked your interest originally? Were you trying to resolve something in yourself or was this all an intellectual curiosity?
That's what people say about psychiatrists. You became one to solve your problems. Believe me, I got enough other people's problems to solve. But no, it's actually, Patricia, a genetic illness in my family because both of my parents were psychiatrists and psychoanalysts, and they told me I was free to be any kind of psychiatrist I wanted to be. So here I am. My father went into the army when World War II started, and he was a battalion surgeon. And he was doing an analysis training as well. And the analyst actually said something at the end of the session. He said, would you like to learn about hypnosis? And my father thought, what did I say wrong? It turned out that there was a Viennese refugee, Gustav von Aschaffenburg, who was a forensic psychiatrist and had to leave Vienna because of the Nazis. And he had a smallpox scar on his forehead. And he noticed when he was interviewing a lot of these prisoners, suddenly their eyes would close and they'd nod and they just seemed different. And so he started studying hypnosis and he volunteered to teach it to young army doctors. So my father started using it in combat in North Africa for treating combat stress reactions and pain. And when he came back, he went back to his psychoanalytic training, but he got told that's not proper. Freud gave up hypnosis. Who are you? And think about it. Hypnosis is actually the oldest Western conception of a psychotherapy. It's the first time that a talking interaction between a doctor and a patient was thought to have therapeutic potential. And yet it's been a sideshow for the last 250 years. And that's why I built Reverie and I'm doing this to help people take advantage of this phenomenon. The other answer to your question is that, so when I got to medical school, I signed up for a hypnosis course. I figured I had to learn more about it. And the first patient I ever wound up using it with was a 15-year-old asthmatic at Children's Hospital in Boston. The nurse says, Spiegel, your patient's in room 354, and I'm following the sound of the wheezing down the hall. And I go in the room, and here's this pretty 15-year-old redhead, knuckles white, struggling for breath. Her mother's standing there crying, nurse in the room. I didn't know what to do. They tried epinephrine subcutaneously twice. It hadn't worked. The next step was general anesthesia or steroids. So while I'm thinking, well, maybe I could try using hypnosis. So I asked her if she'd like to learn a breathing exercise, and she nodded. And I got her hypnotized. And then I realized we hadn't gotten to asthma in the course yet. So I came up with something very subtle and very clever. I said, each breath you take will be a little deeper and a little easier. Within 5 minutes, she's lying back in bed. Her knuckles aren't white. She's not wheezing anymore. Her mother stopped crying. The nurse ran out of the room. My intern comes looking for me. And I figure he's going to slap me on the back and say, nice going, Spiegel. He said, the nurse has filed a complaint with the nursing supervisor that you violated Massachusetts law by hypnotizing a minor without parental consent. Now, Massachusetts has a lot of dumb laws, but that's not on the list. And her mother was standing right next to me when I did it. So he said, well, you're going to have to stop doing this. And I said, why? He said, it's dangerous. And that's the mythology about hypnosis. They either think it's useless or silly or dangerous, or some extreme, none of which are true. And I said, you're about to give her general anesthesia and you think my talking to her is dangerous? I don't think so. And I was a third-year medical student. I was flirting with the end of my career at that point. But I said, I'll tell you what, you have the right to take me off the case if you want, but as long as she's my patient, I'm not going to tell her anything I know is not true. And that's not true. So the intern stormed out. And there was a council of war with the chief resident, the attending. And on Monday, they came back with a radical idea for Children's Hospital. They said, let's ask the patient. I don't think they'd ever done that before. And she said, I like this. Now, she'd been hospitalized every month for 3 months, did have one subsequent hospitalization, but went on to study to be a respiratory therapist. And I figured that anything that could help a patient that much, that fast, 5 minutes, you watched it happen and violated a non-existent Massachusetts law, had to be worth looking into. So that was the first of some 7,000 people I've used hypnosis with in my career.
Wow. Two things. Where did it get the reputation for being useless, silly, or dangerous? And what was actually happening when you helped in 5 minutes this struggling asthmatic patient?
Maybe I'll answer that one first because I've just talked about her. What happens in situations, asthma is highly stressful. When you have an asthma attack, you're struggling for breath. You're afraid you're going to suffocate. It gets your heart rate up, your blood pressure up. But here's what's happening. You're in a struggle with your body. You say, oh my God, it's not working right. And the more tense you get, the more bronchoconstriction you get if you're asthmatic. And so it's like a snowball rolling downhill. It just picks up speed. You struggle, your body gets more tense. You notice that you get more tense emotionally and on it goes. So instead, what we did was we go from the body up rather than the brain down. You use your brain and say to your body, each breath you take will be a little deeper and a little easier. And suddenly you can notice you have the opposite expectation that it's going to get better, not that it's getting worse. So she started to notice that when I just gave her that instruction in hypnosis, she started to feel that she could breathe deeper and more easily. And that broke this cycle of psychological and physical tension that can make many asthma attacks worse than they are anyway. It's a capacity of using the brain to control what it can control. The autonomic nervous system, heart rate, blood pressure, muscle tension, those are things that we can control. You'll notice that you do it. If you meditate, you do other things that get your brain in a state where your body feels better. So that's why this happened. I just broke that cycle and helped her see that her brain-body control could include making it feel better, not just suffering and making it feel worse.
Okay, hold the useless, silly, and dangerous question to the side for a second. How is what you did with that woman different from a guided visualization that would have the same intention or even like some specific breath work that is intended to downregulate your nervous system?
Yeah, we do breath work, and some parts of the Reverie app include cyclic sighing and box breathing and other breath work things. They're related, but here's the thing with hypnosis. To the extent that you're hypnotizable, you can do this very fast and in a very focused way. So unlike other techniques that are more indirect or like meditation, where you're not supposed to do it for a reason, you're just supposed to let things happen and get away from your intentionality, get over yourself. I had one woman who'd meditated for 10 years and she had migraines that she had just the same as when she started 10 years earlier. And she learned self-hypnosis to imagine a cap of ice on her head. And the migraines went away. And she said, thank you for releasing my intentionality. I don't feel guilty about it. And I don't have migraines. So hypnosis is highly focused and it's Western. It's focused on solving a problem. Unlike meditation, where there are people who do it every day, sometimes twice a day, and join the club of meditators. With hypnosis, I'm not trying to get a bunch of people walking around hypnotized all the time. I'm trying to say, when you need it, use it. Here's how. And so it can happen very quickly. You can watch it happen. People can feel it happen and intensifies your ability that you mobilize sometimes spontaneously when you do breath work or other kinds of meditative or other practices. But it's more intense, more focused, and often more effective.
I feel like I'm not very suggestible personally. Like when I've done certain alternative treatments, sometimes if I believe they're going to work, they're better than if I'm just like, this isn't going to work. And I label that my own suggestibility. But how do you determine someone's hypnotizability?
We have a standard test called the hypnotic induction profile that I use with every patient I see in person. And on the Reverie app now, we have the hypnotizability test. And so in about 6 minutes, you can go through a structured hypnotic induction. You look up, close your eyes, take a deep breath. You have an experience of one hand or the other floating up in the air. And then you challenge that. You pull it down and see if the hand wants to float up. And many people are very surprised at how the hand, it feels different. It feels not as much a part of my body. It wants to go up. You then ask them to pull it down and it floats right back up again. And then you give them a signal to go back to their original condition. And we can have a way of scoring it. And on the Reverie app, we categorize people in three categories. One are the most highly hypnotizable people. We call them the poets. They just get into it with their hearts and experience it and don't judge it. People in the mid-range, which is the majority of people, are what we call the diplomats. They have the experience and then they think about it and say, well, is this possible? Can I really be doing this? Is my breathing really better? And then they go back and have more of the experience and so on. And the third, the least hypnotizable group, we call them the researchers. They're curious and interested, but it sounds like what you're saying about yourself, that they want to judge and evaluate, and they're always a little skeptical about it. Now, it helps to some extent if you're more hypnotizable. This is about hypnosis. But it's not necessary, because we couple hypnosis. And this is, you mentioned earlier that this seems different from some other things you've learned about how people use hypnosis. This is not putting people to sleep. You don't have to spend 20 minutes counting upstairs and downstairs. And the therapeutic strategies we use in relationship to hypnosis involve a way of taking advantage of whatever hypnotizability you have, but also doing a strategy that helps. So, for example, I wasn't telling her to calm down. I wasn't telling her, there, it's not that bad. I was telling her, there's a path by which you can make your body and yourself more comfortable. Let's try it. And so we're focusing on what you're for, not what you're against. The worst thing to tell someone is, don't think about purple elephants. What happened? Or don't worry. When doctors tell me don't worry, that's when I get nervous. So instead, we structure interventions that help people find a pathway to feel good about what they're doing and to start to feel better right away, even if they've still got the problem.
So this is interesting, because this is similar to what we learn in mindfulness, where it's really important to stay present with what is difficult. And in that process, change your relationship to the pain or to whatever it is, the anxiety. That does sound like it's a little similar.
It's similar, and you have to do that to get there. But what we add in hypnosis with pain, for example, is that the strain in pain lies mainly in the brain. And what you decide is painful or not has to do with the way your brain interprets signals. We have EEG and fMRI research that shows that people in hypnosis can literally change how much pain they feel, how their brain reacts to the same signals. So you can actually have the experience in hypnosis of manipulating and changing your pain experience. I had a patient yesterday who would play with her pain. She would give it a color and change the color. It was red hot and now it's cool and blue. Move it around, filter the hurt out of the pain. So we encourage people to use their ability to literally try to make a change in the pain, not just tolerate it, but change it and have a sense of control. Because part of what's awful about pain is you're uncomfortable and you think you've been sentenced to just suffering. And that makes it worse right off the bat. So instead you say, well, I've got this. I've got to do something about it. How can I manage it in a way that makes me less uncomfortable? Why do I have to always focus on the pain? We're pretty fragile creatures. And if you get hurt, you better do something about it. So our brains tell us, oh, you may have sprained your ankle or something. You better do something. But we tend to treat all pain as if it were acute pain, because there are a lot of pains we have that really don't indicate anything new is going wrong with your body. You just have to deal with it. You don't have to devote all your attention to it the way you would if you just walked into a wall. So hypnosis is a way of taking a more active and positive stance toward whatever the problem is and seeing what you can do to modulate it.
Yeah, it does seem like often with pain, it's what we call the secondary pain that really causes the catastrophizing and makes the pain worse. And what I was reading in one of the research studies is that what you're doing with hypnosis, tell me if this is correct, is reducing your perception of pain versus reducing the pain itself, which is maybe what you were saying about the brain, or is that not correct?
It's some of both, Patricia, because you are changing the pain. So we did an experiment with a bunch of bright Stanford undergrads who were highly hypnotizable, and we gave them a series of shocks to their wrist, and we recorded the electrical evoked response. So like your device that uses EEG, we used EEG and measured the brain's response. And there are typically, when you do an evoked signal, and this was a shock, so it was pain, wasn't terribly painful, but it was painful. There are three components to the wave. There's the P100, that's 100 milliseconds after the shock, P200, 200 milliseconds, then P300, a third of a second after the shock. The P100 in the hypnosis condition. So there, we just said, your hand isn't circulating ice water. It's cool, tingling, and numb. Filter the hurt out of the pain. And the P100 disappeared. So within a tenth of a second, the brain was acting as though it wasn't feeling that pain.
So it wasn't a desensitization process?
No, it's very fast. You're saying, see if you can modulate it and see it differently. The P200 and the P300 were half as big as they were before. So it isn't simply, and we've shown, for example, that the wording you use, the type of imagery changes the way the brain modulates the pain. So if you tell people this filter they heard out of the pain, you reduce activity primarily in the somatosensory cortex, the part of the brain that processes physical sensation. If you tell them something different, you say, well, the pain's there, but it won't bother you that much. It's no big deal, which is sometimes the way people on opioids feel. You get pain reduction, but now it's in a different part of the brain, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, which is part of our salience network, tells us when to worry and when not to. So just changing the language in hypnosis changes the part of the brain that helps you to manage pain.
So I'm dealing with a rotator cuff little injury.
Sorry.
And having pain at night. So I was telling you, I was listening to hypnosis YouTube audios last night. What would be the self-hypnosis strategy that I would use when I get into bed to limit or reduce the pain?
The first strategy is to try the Reverie hypnosis app. You get to hear my mellifluous voice giving you these instructions, and pain control, insomnia, stress management are all part of it. It's available for download from the App Store. It's interactive. So I ask a question about how you're responding, and then the next step has to do with the answer you've given me. So it's as much like being in the office with me as we can make it. For pain, is there some physical remedy you do? Does a warm shower or a warm bath help?
Heating pad, all of that. But I'm thinking if I want to do self-hypnosis, what would that process look like for me?
So I would tell you to look up, close your eyes, take a deep breath. Let your breath out very slowly, your eyes relax, your body float. Maybe let one hand or the other float up in the air like a balloon so that you're aware that you're changing the way your body feels. And then I would say, now I want you to imagine that you're doing the thing that gives you the most relief. So you're getting into this nice warm bath. You're feeling the warmth penetrate deeper and deeper and let it filter the hurt out of the pain. So you take advantage of the actual physical situation that gives you relief because your brain still remembers it. It has associations to what that feels like. And you realize that you can modulate the pain perception even without doing the physical thing at that time that gives you pain relief.
That's amazing. I was actually starting to feel very relaxed as you were doing that.
Cool. That's it. It's fun that you can tell right away. You don't have to take it from me. Just try it and see what it feels like. And the nice thing is that you can tell right away. We find that 4 out of 5 of the people who use that technique for pain control feel immediate pain relief.
I'm going to talk to you about some serious conditions that we all deal with from time to time. But back to the useless, silly, and dangerous, weren't people using this on television or to do crazy things? Why did hypnosis go in that direction? What happened along the way from it being therapeutic to being some kind of silly, make people do things?
Hypnosis started as a Western tradition in the late 18th century. You know the term mesmerized, you feel mesmerized, by the way. Franz Anton Mesmer was a Viennese physician. He called it animal magnetism. He discovered that patients who he would put into this altered state by putting them near, he thought it was actually a magnetic field. So he'd put them near a paquet with iron filings in it that were slightly magnetized. And some people would look up and their heads would fall and they'd go into some kind of a thing that looked seizure-like. But they'd open their eyes later and they'd say, I feel better, doctor. Thank you. And just the idea that you can change your physical perception and state can be a relief because you often think you're condemned to misery. So think about the leading medical treatments at the time. It was mostly bloodletting. So unless you happen to have a rare blood disease or congestive heart failure, doctors were more likely to kill you than help you if they got to treat you because the treatments were not effective and they were potentially harmful. Voltaire wrote to his brother, we did everything we could to save father's life. We even sent the doctors away. So Mesmer, he got quite a reputation in Vienna. He left his wife and family there and moved to Paris. And he became like the go-to celebrity doctor, which did not endear him to the other French physicians. And descriptions of his office are very interesting. It was cheerful, bright. There were lots of patients around, and they were talking to each other about how they were doing. Whereas the typical French doctor's office was drab and dark and one at a time, and it was demoralizing. So he created a mental atmosphere that made people feel better. So his competition, the rest of the French physicians, got King Louis to form a commission to investigate him. And they concluded that animal magnetism was nothing but heated imagination. Now, I actually think that's not a bad description of it. But because Mesmer had this theory about magnetic fluids and that his magnetic fields next to the patients would make the patient's magnetic fields get better rather than his get worse, I never knew why. The panel that investigated him included our own Benjamin Franklin, who was having a very good time in Paris those days, the famous and brilliant chemist Lavoisier, who discovered the principles of oxygen chemistry and invented 3 months before he died, the notion of the gross national product. So brilliant in economics, too. He was beheaded in the French Revolution. And we've got to remember that a lot of these crazy movements become very hostile to brilliant scientific people who are contributing to knowledge. And that has some relevance to our lives today as well, unfortunately. And the other person who was on the panel was a guy named Dr. Guillotin, the inventor of the guillotine. He created the mind-body problem. And that panel concluded that it was nothing but heated imagination. That was the end of Mesmer's career. And so you started out if you used hypnosis, and there were people like James Braid and Esdale, British physicians who used it in the 19th century in India, using hypnosis as the only anesthesia for amputations that were being done. And he reported 80% surgical anesthesia with hypnosis. Ether was introduced a little while later. And at Mass General Hospital, there was the first demonstration of ether anesthesia. The surgeon strode to the front of the amphitheater and said, "Gentlemen, this is no humbug," to distinguish it from hypnosis. People don't get the idea that our brain actually controls our body, that it is this complex, wonderful 3-pound machine on the top of our bodies that help us run everything, but it doesn't come with a user's manual. And so we often aren't aware of the capacities that our brains have to help us. And part of the problem is that we also have this body mechanic idea about what real medical treatment is, which is ingestion, injection, or incision. You've got to do something physical or nothing's going to happen. And you know from your knowledge of meditation and other techniques that that's just not true, that you can do real things with your brain that make a real difference in your body and in your experience. So hypnosis either gets trivialized or people say it's dangerous and you shouldn't be using it.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle.
Now, the thing that really makes my skin crawl, and is another reason why I have Reverie out there now, is we lost last year 70,000 Americans to opioid overdoses. We've lost 300,000 over the last 10 years. those drugs are killing Americans at an astonishing rate, more than shotgun deaths, and God knows there's enough gun deaths in this country, and more than automobile accidents. Now, hypnosis has not yet killed a single person. The worst thing that happens is it doesn't work. So we have a situation where they say hypnosis is weird or dangerous or something, but we're spending billions on drugs that are killing people. And opioids are good acute care for pain, and they're terrible chronic care for pain. It really frustrates me that people don't take us seriously because of this ongoing prejudice that if you're just doing it with your mind, it isn't real. And nothing could be farther from the truth.
That is incredibly frustrating. I had a pain expert on the show a while back, and he was talking about sham surgery, where they took three patients, and I think it was a knee surgery, and they put them all under anesthesia. One of them, they didn't even do any surgery. And afterwards, he was the one that felt the best. He was explaining, in a way, something similar, which is like the power of the mind, which placebo gets a bad rap too. And what is that intersection between placebo and hypnosis? Because placebo is really your mind telling you.
Yes, absolutely. The placebo effect is one of the most effective treatments we have. And you're right. Just expectation alone that you're going to get better makes a lot of people get better. I was in a meeting with some big pharma reps about antidepressants at a time when we were just beginning to realize how effective they can be, and they are. And this guy was shaking his head. He said, "This is terrible." He said, "A third of people just don't respond. Two thirds do respond." Now, that's pretty good, except the more people come to believe that antidepressants actually work, the more respond to placebo as if it were the antidepressant. So the story now is a third don't respond, a third respond to the placebo, and a third get the real pharmacological effect. Now, that's something that's important. I use antidepressants with my patients all the time. But that expectation has a powerful effect as well. And let's take advantage of it. Now, there was a study done in which they had people who were low and high in hypnotizability put their hands in circulating ice water. And you can tell how much discomfort you're inflicting by how cold the water is. And for people who were not hypnotized, placebo and the hypnosis, the high and low hypnosis group were the same, basically. The ones who were hypnotized had far more analgesia, more pain relief. They could tolerate more time in a cold water bath than the low hypnotizable. So hypnosis, the foundation is the placebo effect, but it's more powerful than that.
When you talk about depression, because I wanted to go through some of these conditions, and depression was actually going to come later, but since you mentioned it, does it depend on where you are on the depression spectrum? Serious chemical depression maybe doesn't respond to medication, or do those statistics that you were sharing apply across the board with depression?
In general, I'll often do both, but the more serious the depression is, particularly with depression, anxiety, a broader range of people with anxiety can respond very quickly. People who are really depressed, but they often have both. And I would say that I tend for very serious depression, and certainly when I'm worried about someone possibly harming themselves, I'll try everything and usually use medication. But it's easy to try adding hypnosis to whatever else you're doing and see whether that helps. I had a woman earlier this year who came from a country that is famous for treating women horribly. And she said, as a teenage girl, I'd walk down the street and my body wasn't my own. Men felt they could say anything they wanted. And she'd been depressed. She got to the U.S. She became a healthcare professional, but throughout her life, she was depressed. She retired early. And it turned out that at the age of 12, she was raped by her landlord. And her parents were afraid to do anything about it because they didn't want to be thrown out of the house. And, you know, it's often victims are not believed and things like that. I got her hypnotized. And I said, "I want you to go back now and look at your 12-year-old self. Pretend you're your own mother. And I want you to look at yourself right after you were raped." And she started to cry. And I said, "I have one question for you. Was this your fault?" And she said, "I'm stroking her hair. I'm stroking her hair." And she came out of the hypnosis. She called me a week later and she said, "Dr. Spiegel, my psychiatrist wants to know what you did to me because I'm not depressed anymore." And she said, "My friends don't recognize me." And I just got a text message from her a month ago saying, I thank God that I was referred to you. I'm still feeling great. I'm not depressed. Thank you.
Was it because you had her in a state where facing a situation from the past, she was able to resolve that, and that was the cause of her depression?
I think a lot of it was. Many sexual assault survivors blame themselves for events they didn't control. The trauma is not about pain or fear. It's about helplessness. You're turned into an object, and we hate that for good reasons. So often, you'd rather feel guilty than helpless. And so people blame themselves for not having foreseen that it could happen, or why did you walk through the park to go to the drugstore at 3 p.m. on a Saturday where that guy was? And so throughout her life, she had basically blamed herself. And of course, there are cultures where women have to be covered up because they're sexually provocative. So if they're not covered up, so whatever happens to them is somehow their fault. What I did was release her from this lifelong belief that somehow this was her fault and she deserved it. And that's what did it.
That seemed to have really hit the nail on the head. When I was reading about what happens with hypnosis for people with anxiety, is you talk about most people with anxiety disorders understand that at some level, there's a lack of definition or catastrophizing, or there's just this amorphous thing that is very distracting and confusing. And if you convert anxiety to fear, it gives it a focus. So can you share a little bit about how that works?
That's well stated. And you try to convert anxiety into fear. That's exactly right. So you can deal with it. You try to convert depression into sadness, which is what I did with that woman. With anxiety, one of the funny, I was seeing a lovely new patient yesterday who had been very depressed and was anxious, and got so anxious when she got some news about her, some of her family moving away, that her face started to twitch, and she got really frightened by that. And of course, it suddenly becomes very public and visible. And many people with anxiety, and I asked her before the face twitching started, I said, how anxious are you right now? She said, oh, 7 out of 10. And she looked calm and composed. And many people with anxiety are struggling to prevent anybody from getting any indication that they're anxious, which is, what does it do? It makes them more anxious. That's what, it doesn't work. And so I said, you're bottling it up inside and you're adding to your burden by trying to over-control your anxiety. So what if you're anxious? I tell people who have public speaking anxiety, I say, so you look anxious. That's a compliment to your audience, that you're worried about how they're going to react to you. It's not a problem. So let them see if you're anxious. So I had her, she was very hypnotizable. And her face is starting to twitch, and I had her floating in a warm bath. And then I said, I want you to stroke your face. Let your hand float over and stroke your face. And so for about 5 minutes, she was there just stroking her cheek, and gradually the twitching stopped. And I said, so don't struggle with your body over this. Your body is helping you to express something you're feeling. That's okay. Acknowledge it and comfort your body while it does this. And the twitching stopped and she felt less anxious than she had before. And so it's a matter of, you're right, switching anxiety into fear, understanding what it is, but not doing things that make it worse rather than better.
It sounds like what you're doing is you're integrating hypnosis into traditional and innovative psychotherapy. You're like the full toolbox, would you say?
Absolutely. I'm not a hypnotist. I'm a psychiatrist. And one of the tools I use is hypnosis, and it can be very powerful and effective. But if it isn't, I got a bunch of other things I can do, or I can combine them. That's absolutely right.
So how does hypnosis or self-hypnosis, getting back to insomnia, let's go through some of these conditions and talk about how to train the brain, practical tools.
When we built Reverie, we spent years making it as much like being in my office with me and being there to help you do it. And I thought, is it almost as good as that? And the results we're getting indicate that it is at least almost as good. But then I thought, one of the major things we use it for is people waking up in the middle of the night and having trouble getting back to sleep. And I thought, you probably don't want me in your bedroom at 3 a.m. hypnotizing you to go back to sleep. So in many ways, this is better because I'm there in your smartphone anytime you want it. And so what I tell people to do is, first of all, get your body comfortable. imagine you're floating in a bath, a lake, a hot tub, or just floating in space. I do some cyclic sighing. And I don't know if you've done that technique, but it's very simple and very helpful. And I combine it with the hypnosis. And so I'll ask you, and if you want to try it, you can try it now, to just inhale abdominally. So let your belly come out, a diaphragmatic inhale, stop halfway. Now expand your chest and fill your lungs. And now slowly, very slowly, exhale through your mouth. Let's try it two more times. Inhale through your belly at first. Stop. Fill your lungs. And then slowly exhale through your mouth. And one more time. Expand your belly. Stop. Expand your chest. Slowly exhale through your mouth. How are you feeling?
Tired.
I'm not sure that's a good thing or not.
Relax.
good. Well, tired in a way that you could more easily go to sleep. And the next thing we do is I say, okay, now I want you to picture in your mind's eye an imaginary screen. So while your body is floating in a bath, a lake, a hot tub, or floating in space, whatever's going through your mind, just imagine you're watching it as a home movie. So you try and get it out of your body. You dissociate your physical state from your mental state. Because what keeps people up often is they're so frustrated. And the more frustrated they get, the more they wake themselves up. One thing I tell people is do not be able to look at your clock in the middle of the night, because all you're doing is waking yourself up when you see what time it is. Doesn't matter what time it is. Get your body comfortable floating and project your thoughts onto an imaginary screen. And so you become a passive observer of what you're thinking, but you dissociate your physiological reaction to those thoughts from the thoughts themselves. So it keeps you from stimulating arousal rather than relaxation. And many, many people find this helps them get to sleep or get back to sleep.
Okay, good. We're going to try that. That sounds great. What's happening in the brain? Is that the same as what you were describing before?
Yes, you're right. So we've done studies where we take high and low hypnotizable people and put them in the scanner, and in some conditions hypnotize them, in others we don't. And we look at what happens. And three things happen in the brain when people go into hypnosis. One is they turn down activity in the salience network, in the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus. This is a pattern matching part of the brain that says, uh-oh, something weird's happening. You hear a loud noise. And is that a gunshot? Oh my God, in this country, it often is. So that arouses you. And getting your sympathetic nervous system going is exactly what you don't need when you want to go to sleep. You want the parasympathetic system control. So turning down the salience network allows you to minimize your reaction to stimuli that could be arousing or threatening. That's number one. Number two, you increase what we call functional connectivity, coordinated activity between the executive control network in the prefrontal cortex and the insula, which is a major mind-body node in the middle of the brain. Insula means island. It's this little island in the middle of the brain. And it controls both brain instructions to the body and what we call interoception, brain perception of what's happening in the body. So you have more control over what you're perceiving in your body and the extent to which it arouses or doesn't arouse your body when you're having those thoughts or feelings. The third thing that happens is, to the extent that you're thinking and doing that, you inhibit activity in the posterior cingulate cortex. That's part of what we call the default mode network. It's the part of the brain where you think about yourself when you're not doing anything else and you're wondering, what kind of a person am I? What do my friends think about me? Who am I? It's something that is very important, but it can also inhibit you from changing. And we find that when you cut that loose, and this happens in meditation too, that people turn down activity in that part of the brain, you're freer to try out being different. Even though I'm always like this when I think about that, you can try what it's like to not feel like that and see how it feels. So those are the things that happen in the brain when people go into a hypnotic state. And all of them can be very helpful in inducing relaxation, handling stress better, and getting to sleep.
Thank you for explaining that in such a way that most of us can understand. So I appreciate that. I promised my partner I would ask you about phobias because he has a fear of heights. And I've seen him like when we in a tall building that has a terrace in New York City, or we climb mountains in Colorado, he does it, but you see him trying to just get through it when he, if he looks in a certain direction. And so he's always had that, and curious, like how we handle phobias like that.
Sure. For fear of heights, there are a couple of phobias I can talk about. For fear of heights, first of all, you want to be able to get some control of your body. So prepare yourself before you get there. Say, I'm going to make my body feel comfortable now, floating in a bath or lake, a hot tub, or just lying on a comfortable couch, someplace where you feel secure and comfortable. And then I want you to imagine now that you're going up in the elevator and you're going to get out at the 30th floor or whatever it is. And I want you to put yourself where you're going to be when you look out there, but with one difference. This is real animal magnetism. I want you to feel gravity magnetically connecting your feet to the floor. Because many people with these phobias, they look out, they look over, and they feel like they're being pulled off wherever they are. In fact, the gravitational forces are designed to keep you exactly where you are. And so you focus on your feet, on your connection to the floor, and you feel in control of your body's general arousal, but you also re-experience this situation as one in which gravity is connecting your body to exactly where you are, and you're not going to go anywhere unless you decide to do it. And that gives people a sense of control and connection to where they want to be, not where they're afraid of. You don't focus on your fear. I'll tell you one other story. You're in New York. My father's practice was in Manhattan, and there was a woman who had a terrible phobia of dogs. It's hard to avoid dogs in Midtown Manhattan, and she would plan her going to the store when there were less likely to be people with dogs. Good luck. Her husband was a very wealthy man. He was having a big fancy dinner at a hotel in Midtown, and a woman came into the room with a cute little French poodle, and she screamed, stood up, knocked the table over, so all the food and drink was all over the place. And her husband said to her, you get fixed or get out of our marriage. I can't stand this. So she got to my father and he hypnotized her and said, it makes sense to be afraid of wild animals. Some of them are dangerous, but some animals are not. So I want you to find a friend who has a dog and who won't trick you and have him hold the dog. And when you're ready, approach the dog. And she said, I'm thinking of a dog friend. And she finally was able to pet the dog. And she was very pleased. About 6 months later, my father called just to see how she was doing. And a little boy answered the phone and he said, is your mama there? And he said, yes, who's calling, please? And my father said, Dr. Spiegel. And there was a long pause and the little boy said, that's funny. Spiegel's in heat.
I knew you were going to say that.
We talk about transference in psychiatry. So she got a dog and named it Spiegel.
I wish we could hypnotize dogs. That would facilitate the training process, wouldn't it?
You can get animals' attention. So there are ways of doing things with animals. And dogs, they're very social creatures. They're very attentive to the emotions of the people. You have control. There's actually one randomized behavioral control with dogs. And it's not exactly hypnosis, but it's close. The one intervention was when you bring the dog's food for dinner, you tell the dog to sit and you don't give them the food until they sit. You don't tell them twice or three times. You just wait. And what you're teaching the dog is that if he wants dinner, he better sit. And those dogs were in general better behaved than the ones that didn't have that simple intervention. So actually we can with animals.
Just doing that one intervention, that would have saved me lots of money on dog training. I wish I had met you a year ago.
I wish you had too.
I want to ask you another question, and we're coming to the end of our time together, but how have you used hypnosis as it relates to peak performance? Have you worked with athletes? Have you worked with business professionals that are trying to really build companies? I know you're at Stanford, so you are at the heart of a lot of this.
That's right. That's why every Stanford professor has to have their own startup. So that's why I built Reverie. But the coach of the Stanford women's swimming team came to me a while ago. They're a fabulous team. They're really good. Because he'd noticed that their times were faster in practice than they were in meets. Now, you would think it would be the opposite, right? You're really up for the meet and you're doing it. But what we discovered was is that they were distracting themselves by focusing on what the women in the next lanes were doing. And competitive swimming is not a contact sport. It doesn't matter what they're doing. I got them hypnotized and I said, here's how you're going to practice. You're going to practice swimming your best swim and just focus on your relationship to your body, how you feel in your body, and how you cooperate with your body to swim as efficiently and as rapidly as you can, and what it feels like to do that. And practice that. Practice swimming your best swim, regardless of what else is going on around. And their times got better in meets.
Yeah.
What you want to do in performance, athletic performance, but in actually in business too, is focus more on the process and less on the outcome.
Is that on the effort?
Effort, but not in an effortful way. What you want to do is actually make it more like a flow state where you're just connecting with your body or your mind, depending on what the task is, and enjoying your absorption in the task and not worrying about the outcome. Zen in the Art of Archery, Suzuki said that it's a mistake to focus on the target. If your relationship with the bow and arrow is correct, it will wind up in the target where you want it. But you disconnect yourself from, and that's a big part of what we do with hypnosis, is you focus, you practice doing what you want to do, but focus on getting into and enjoying the practice, whether it's planning or budgeting or writing a novel or swimming. Immerse yourself in the experience of doing it well and don't worry about the outcome because that just distracts you.
How have you used self-hypnosis on yourself?
I had a recurrent dislocating shoulder from a motor scooter accident, and it was really annoying. So I finally found a really good surgeon. He was the guy who treated, I don't know if you remember Bobby Orr with the Boston Bruins, but he fixed his knee. And so I thought, this is my guy. And so he rebuilt my shoulder. And the surgery itself was 3 hours. So I had general anesthesia. But afterwards, they had all this pain medication prescribed. I wasn't taking it. And because I worked at the Mass General, I walked over and looked at my record. Otherwise, they wouldn't have let me do it. And the resident wrote, patient using very little pain medication. We mustn't have cut many nerves.
God.
Now, I have an incision from the top to the bottom of my shoulder. I can assure you they cut nerves. But that's this prejudice. The pain control can't be real if you're not using opioids. And that's just not true. So that's one example. I used it for performance. I was trying to water ski. And I kept winding up face flat in the water. And I just hypnotized before myself and said to myself, arms straight, knees bent. Arms straight, knees bent. Because you often do the opposite. That is, you try and cushion your control by bending your arms and keeping your knees straight. And that's a setup for falling into the water. And that worked. So I'm not a great water skier, but I can water ski.
I love how you can integrate this into so many different things in life. And just to your shoulder example, I was just talking to somebody about shoulder surgery. It's supposed to be extremely painful afterwards. So
yeah, it can be. But then again, you can learn to manage the pain and it's there, but it's not terrible.
Yeah, it's not owning you.
Right, exactly.
My last question to you, unless there are some things you would like to add. What three pieces of advice, and I ask this to all my guests, what three pieces of advice would you give your younger self?
My younger self, interesting. I would say keep thinking about opportunities and don't put them off if they come your way. Take full advantage of opportunities and take the risk that it won't work or it won't work out the way you thought it would or you'll fail at it. That's fine. Give it a try because the worst regret, I had a patient the other day who said, I don't want to wake up 20 years from now and think, what have I done with my life? And so I'd say that's certainly one of them. I'd say cultivate your loved ones, your family, your friends. It's good for them and it's really good for you. So make the most of those opportunities and take risks. Give yourself a chance to do things your way and see what happens. And my advice for your listeners is try Reverie, R-E-V-E-R-I. There are a bunch of things that we've talked about today, Patricia, and you can try it out and see what it feels like. And you'll know very quickly whether it's likely to help you or not. It's a legacy project for me. I want people to have access to what I've learned about helping people manage these problems in their lives, whether I'm around to do it or not. And I also want to, 25% of the American population has a serious anxiety problem, and a tiny fraction of them, and those with depression too, actually get to any form of mental health care. And I'm thinking we now have this tremendous ability to disseminate knowledge and develop these interactive programs, and they're right there in your smartphone with you wherever you are. That's a real opportunity for us to spread the wealth and help people take advantage of what we know about helping themselves live better. So for me, it's a challenge and a wonderful opportunity to help people live better.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I'm going to try it. So I'm looking forward to that. Dr. Spiegel, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been so interesting. I definitely want more on this. So I really appreciate
it. I'm glad. Thank you for your doing what you're doing and making it possible for me to get to people to hear about this. And I wish you the best.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us today. For more information on Dr. Spiegel and his work with hypnosis, check out the Reverie app in the Apple or Google app stores. You might also want to check out the Andrew Huberman podcast where he hypnotized Huberman live. That was interesting. Now, time to go check out the hundreds of meditations that are free at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. And if you have suggestions or comments for us, as always, reach out at untangle@choosemuse.com. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.